Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. For the fifth time in 7 years of our show, I am pleased to welcome today's guest, Bradley Wright, an associate professor of sociology at the University of Connecticut. Professor Wright is the principal investigator of an ongoing smartphone research project called Soul Pulse that we have discussed here in a previous podcast and that has been featured in the New Yorker magazine as well as a few other places. Beyond running Soul Pulse, Brad conducts research in the sociology of religion, the sociology of crime, as well as the subfield of social psychology. He has authored two great books that have been featured on our program. The first, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told, and Upside, Surprising Good News About the State of Our World. We had him on the show most recently talking about a fascinating study of how various churches respond to inquiries from different racial groups. Today, though, we bring him in to talk about another facet of his broad research agenda and the topic of a recent lead article in Christianity Today, The Science of Sinning. This project was funded by the John Templeton Foundation and involved a couple other scholars, including Roy Baumeister, a social psychologist from Florida State, Go Seminoles, and David Carrion, a psychiatrist and neuroscientist at Stanford University. I would say go whatever their mascot is, but I don't know what it is, and they're a rival of the University of Washington, so there you have it, Stanford. Anyways, we will link to Brad's personal website, The Wonderful World of Soul Pulse, his books, and other fun stuff at our website, so please stop by and say hi. Brad, welcome back for your fifth trip here to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's a real pleasure. I think this will make my summer.
Okay. It always does. And we usually tend to have you on during the summer, so I'm always worried about making your summer. But we're here to talk about stuff. And before we start sinning, talking about sinning, give us an update on Soul Pulse. The last time we talked to you about that specifically was in our 200th episode, and we're now clocking in at 343. So what's going on with Soul Pulse?
Well, Soul Pulse started. It went, and it actually finished. We unplugged it in April.
Oh.
I didn't tell you this, or else you could have changed your intro.
Yeah.
We got enough people, and there's some maintenance cost to keeping this, the website online, so we collected data for 3.5 years, and now we just have more data than we know what to do with, and we're trying to make sense of it.
Well, some of that data is going to come into play here with the science of sinning stuff, but I'm kind of disappointed to hear that you pulled the plug on it. I was going to direct people to go and participate in it, and I even thought you could create a theme song from it, like the old Soul Train back in the 70s. You know? Soul Pulse, Soul Pulse, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Isn't that a great name, Soul Pulse? I didn't come up with it.
Yeah.
It's a great name.
It is a great name. But 3.5 years of data, got some really cool things on it. We're going to talk about some of the sinning stuff. Has anything else come from it other than the stuff we're going to talk about today?
Absolutely. We have, I think we've published 5 articles out of it so far, and we have like another 6 under review or in press or stuff like that. And the next article that'll come out of this is I want to look at what the effect of going to church is, because we know if somebody went to church on Sunday morning, and then we have measures of how they're feeling and what they're doing on Sunday afternoon. So, you know, kind of under the heading of, does going to church make a difference?
Hmm. Do you have, like, measures of what kind of church was it? Like a Joel Osteen feel-good church versus a...
No, unfortunately, we don't. We have some general measures in terms of the church they usually go to, how connected do they feel to it, do they feel appreciated, is there conflict, but nothing that specific.
Okay, yeah, because I've been to some that make me feel really good, and I've also been, you know, some fire and brimstone ones that come out of going, ugh. So, but let's talk about your most recent study on the science of sinning, as it was titled in a recent Christianity Today cover story. And I have to say, for an academic, getting a cover story, which was written by you, by the way, is really, really cool. So how was that whole experience?
Oh, I love it. I love working with Christianity Today. They have an editor there named Ted Olson, who is, he should be an academic. Well, actually, maybe he wants to make a difference in the world, but he did. He would be a great academic. He's super smart about social science stuff. And, yeah, he's really good. And the title, isn't that a great title, The Science of Sinning?
Yeah.
I didn't come up with it. I learned a while ago, Tony, that with articles for popular magazines and for books, they want to put the title on. So I actually send it to them untitled. Or I come up with a joke title like, you know, my favorite, you know, potluck recipe or something like that.
The science of sinning, as we'll find out, it's a little bit misleading, but not exactly, right? We're going to be talking about self-control and that. The one thing that I thought was really cool about the article as well is that the cover, when you think sinning, you normally think about like sexual indiscretions or criminal activity. Mm-hmm. But the CT story had a different cover photo, and that was what?
It was a donut, a sprinkled donut with, I think, pink frosting.
So how is that sinning? if that's sinning, count me in the church of Dunkin' Donuts. I'm sorry here, you know?
Well, now remember, I had no say over the title or over the cover,
yeah.
But I think it represents a common temptation that we all face. Oh, but can I tell you a funny story about the cover?
Absolutely.
So when the article came out, when the magazine came out, I think like in April, a friend of mine who's a sociologist at Baylor sent me an email, said, when your magazine came, the donut looked so real, my girls thought we had gotten them a donut. And then they started crying when they realized it wasn't. Thanks a lot, Brad.
Yeah, there you go. You're disappointing everybody with all your research.
Yeah, I'm never going to let a donut go on something I write again.
So what's the general impression of getting a Christianity Today article? I mean, did it feel awesome? Did you get a lot of emails from admirers or possibly some hate mail?
Somewhere in between. So I got emails from people who said, hey, this is great, tell me more. And I just got one today saying, you know, it was polite, but it said that the perspective I was taking would lead people to sin more, not less, and that it went against Scripture. And I'm not much at theology, right? So I don't do theology for the same reason I don't do surgery. I'm just not that good at it, and you know, like bad things can happen from me trying. But it's kind of interesting to think about. There's just a lot of issues with self-control. And it was nice that the article stirred them up. And, So I really like writing for Christianity Today. And it's fun having people read my stuff who aren't just peer reviewers or academics who want to cite me for their work.
Yeah, no, that's got to be a fantastic feeling because you do reach a very, very broad audience. And you're able to take some, you know, pretty esoteric research and really make it applicable to stuff. Now, one of the things that you did in the Christianity Today article was to connect your research on self-control to Christianity. Because if you read the paper that we're going to be discussing about here in a minute, it doesn't necessarily discuss Christianity directly. It's not a paper on the sociology of religion per se, although religious faith can work into this. But how did you end up connecting donuts and the Bible and self-control?
Well, I'm a Christian myself, and so in addition to doing research on self-control, I think about how it plays out in everyday life from a Christian worldview. And over the years, I've gotten connected with CT, and so they've given me an opportunity to write about it. And so it's kind of a fun. It's kind of fun for. I enjoy thinking about, you know, the moral issues, the philosophical issues, but also the empirical issues and how to integrate them. Not sure I do it that well, but it's something I really enjoy doing.
Well, one of the things that you did was to go back and go through Scripture and find a bunch of sayings on self-control. And which is always good for me because, you know, I'm not a theology expert either. And, you know, it's got to kind of be in there because self-control would kind of be a big thing. But you did find some of this stuff and you pepper the Christianity Today article with it, which really kind of helps fill out the religious aspect of self-control. And the first one here you quote was Proverbs 25:28, like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. So back in the Old Testament there, they were talking about self-control. But then you even bring it up to the New Testament, and you cite Romans 7:15. Says, I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate to do. And that's Paul talking about himself, trying to say, I really don't want to do this stuff, but I just don't have the self-control of doing it. So did you know where these verses in the Bible were, or did you have to kind of go do a Google search and stuff?
Most of them I had already come across.
Okay.
It's something I've been interested in for a while, so I looked it up. So maybe a Google search of several years ago.
Okay. Well, that's good. There's a few more verses, and we'll link to some of those verses on self-control at our website for those of you who might not know exactly where they are. But that brings us to the topic of self-control. And there's a lot of self-help books out there on how to self-control stuff, but academic studies, has there been a lot of stuff done on what enhances self-control or what doesn't?
There actually has been, and that's why I was so thrilled to be able to work with Roy Baumeister about this. He's the guy who really popularized the study of self-control, and he's written a number of articles, including a New York Times best-selling book entitled Willpower, and that was about self-control. And so the interplay between sort of academic research and improving our lives and others' people's lives interests me a lot. And I think more and more that's where my research is going, and self-control sits squarely there.
So what is this thing, self-control? I know when I don't see it, that's usually in a teenager, but what does it have a specific academic definition that helps us get a feel for it?
Oh, it has a handful of definitions. In general, though, it's being able to regulate our short-term impulses and align them in with our long-term values or goals. So eating a donut or eating a box of donuts shows low self-control if you're trying to lose weight. If you're trying to win an eating contest, then maybe the fact that you ate so many took self-control. I mean, make yourself eat more. Or if you just don't care, then it's not an issue of self-control. So it's really modifying what we do in the moment to make it fit with our longer-term values and goals. So you could think of self-control working to keep us from doing something, like an I won't challenge. You can think of it as motivating us to do something that's difficult, like an I will challenge, or you can think of it as sort of moderating what we do. So for me, a big self-control challenge when we go out for Mexican food is not to eat the whole basket of chips. I want to eat some, but not all of it. And so that would be a third example of how self-control is used.
That's cool that you brought yourself into the story a little bit. You do that in the Christianity Today article, but you don't do it in the academic publication, because that's kind of weird that you would be talking about ourselves. But we'll get back to that in a second, because it was really interesting to see how this research has influenced your own behavior, and it has gotten me to start monitoring my food again. So you're having an impact far and wide here. But in addition to me trying to lose a little bit of weight here, what are some of the other general reasons we should be interested in self-control?
Well, self-control has a huge impact on a number of life outcomes and a number of aspects of well-being. So Temi Moffitt, who's a psychologist at Duke, who I actually did a postdoc with back in the 1930s or whenever I was just out of grad school, she published a big paper, and I think it came out in Science, that where she looked at self-control among young people in the study in New Zealand that she has access to, and found that it predicted like everything good and negatively predicted everything bad in adulthood. So education, crime, drug use, staying married. It's, if the fairy godmother shows up with a wand and to give you one wish, self-control would be a pretty good answer. It'd be a pretty good answer because it leads to so many other good things in life. So that's why it's a practical value. And then it also moderates the interplay between, it moderates people's actions and the social outcomes they have. And so there's sort of a kind of a nice macro-micro story to it as well about how where we are in society and what happens to us affects self-control, and yet how our self-control affects where we are in society.
Now, I'm going to give a little bit of defense for the lack of self-control, because as I was reading through your article, I'm also reading through the biography of Keith Moon. He was one of the greatest drummers in all time, one of the greatest bands, The Who. They didn't have self-control, and they were awesome. What's the deal?
Well, actually, I would think that they would have self-control. Now, I don't know that much about The Who, but from the few rock bands I know about, they often have to go on tour. They have to push themselves to do something they don't feel like doing at the moment. Now, maybe resisting recreational drugs isn't something they exert self-control at, but my impression is that those people have to work really hard to get where they're at, and that would be self-control.
So it comes in a lot of varieties, different forms in different places, and we don't have it all 100%. We have it good in some areas, but bad in others.
Right. Now, that's not to say that everything good in the world comes from self-control.
That's true.
So, as you implied to Keith Moon, we could think of artists who, you know, spontaneously or there's a spontaneity or a creativity or that produces goodness and beauty. That's not necessarily rooted in self-control, and yet it seems the most successful artists are able to, you know, work consistently and work hard for a long period of time, even if they don't see big results.
So this self-control stuff, it sounds like I could just go get some, you know, maybe pick some up at a store, and it's probably not the way it actually occurs. There's been a lot of study, and you mentioned your colleague Baumeister, who has done a lot of stuff on this. What did he find out, and what do we know about how we get self-control or how we lose it?
That's a great question. So we could distinguish between trait self-control and state self-control. So trait self-control are sort of a person's average level of self-control. So when I was growing up, I had a brother and a sister, and I actually still do, and my sister has always been high self-control. She would work out, she'd study hard, she's top in the class, everything. I was low self-control, doing all the stupid things teenage boys did in the 70s and 80s. And so there's just some differences between us. In addition, there's differences within a person. So there's times when a person feels more self-control and a time when they feel less. So sometimes I can, you know, walk past the refrigerator with Ben and Jerry's in it, and I'm just bulletproof. That doesn't even speak to me. Don't even care that it's there. Other times, I mean, it's basically dragging me across the kitchen to the refrigerator. And that's because of differences in self-control within me.
Mm-hmm. So let's before we talk about trait self-control, let's talk about the state one. What are some things that might affect the states that we're in, or what states that we're in affect self-control?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked about state instead of trait, because that's what I'm studying. I think it's just so interesting. So I'm working on an article with Roy Baumeister and David Carey on, and we're looking at when people get depleted from using too much self-control during the day. And then that speaks to a larger literature about what wears us out. So basically, we get more self-control when we do things that, just in lay terms, you can think of energizing. So often sleep helps. When things happen that make us happy, then that makes a difference. We tend to lose self-control when we use it a lot. So you can think of at the end of a really long day, you know, I'm more likely to do a face plant and dessert than I am at the start when I feel energized. Now, there's an interesting interplay between using self-control and having it, in that when we use it, we have less of it in the short term, but we sort of like develop a muscle for it. So in that sense, it's like going to the gym. I'm stronger before a workout than I am after the workout, but if I work out, I get stronger overall.
Mm-hmm. I can see. So there's short-term and there's long-term things, because I'm thinking about myself, right? There are times where I get to the gym and then I'm doing it for a couple months and all of a sudden I stop and I just can't drag myself in for many, many weeks. And then there's also the times, just short-terms in the day, where I like start working out and I'll just quit right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So what are some of the things you mentioned energy and happiness. Does happiness actually bolster self-control, or do we lose self-control with happiness?
From what I understand with this literature, that positive emotions increase self-control. So, you know, that's what's the thing in 12-step programs about how people are at risk when they're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. You know, so it makes a cute little acronym of HALT. And in contrast, when we're feeling better, then it's more we're more able to act on what we think is best in the moment.
Now, some of the other things that affect this stuff might be whether we're tired or the temptations that are put before us. Your colleague Baumeister did an experiment that I think you discussed in the Christianity Today article, or maybe it's in the other one, but it was a brilliant experiment. You got to tell us about this.
So he had students participate in an experiment, which psychologists like to do. And some of them, he gave a plate full of warm, fresh cookies that smelled good, and others he gave radishes. And he put them in front of the students, and then he told them to not eat them. Now, I no offense to the radish lobby that might be listening to this, but many people, myself included, easily resist radishes. But a fresh-baked plate of cookies, and they were careful to make it smell good,
yeah.
That's actually tough. In fact, just talking about it, it's like I want to hang up and like go get something and come back. And so that took some self-control to say no. Then Baumeister had both sets of students solve a math problem. Now, psychologists are always messing with people, which kind of makes me wish I was a psychologist in their research. The math problem had no answer. It was not solvable, but you might think it would be. So the dependent variable is how long people would work on the problem rather than did they solve it. And the people who had radishes in front of them instead of cookies worked on it longer. So resisting cookies burned up some of the energy that was needed to solve a math problem. And so that suggests that self-control isn't sort of fragmented in our life, where like I have self-control for thinking, then I have self-control for energy, like all these different flavors. Rather, it's like we have one reservoir, one pool of self-control, and it goes to the various different types of activities that we do.
You mentioned that self-control is like a muscle and that we can build it over time. Has there been any work done on self-control and how we can create habits for ourselves?
Well, that's this is from Roy's work. Perhaps the most effective use of self-control is to form habits, because self-control itself is limited. It's like the battery in your car. You can use it to start your car, but I suppose unless you have an electric car, you can't get that far on just battery power, but it's really good for starting the engine. Analogously, self-control can be used to create habits, but then when we use habits, they're much more efficient. They use a different part of our brain, and as a result, we can act on habitual behavior much longer and much more successfully than sort of effortful behavior. So, for example, I brushed my teeth this morning, and I brush my teeth every morning, and I don't give it a second thought. It takes no energy. It doesn't deplete me in the least, because it's become a habit. So habitualizing behavior takes some energy, and self-control is a good source of that energy, or it's something you can use to then create the habit.
One of the things that Baumeister has talked about is this difference between automated and controlled behaviors. How does that play into it?
So it's the same principle. Automated behaviors are, habits are an example of automated behavior.
I gotcha.
And then controlled behavior are things that are effortful. So if you ask me to ride my bike down the road and around and back, which I do a couple times a week, I wouldn't have to put any thought into it. It's close to an automated behavior. But if you ask me to kayak in the river down at the end of the hill, I don't kayak. I would have to put a lot of thought into that. And so 10 minutes of kayaking would be a lot more effortful, and it would deplete me a lot more than an hour of bike riding, just because it's a controlled behavior rather than automated.
I see how that works. Yeah, so any kind of new thing that you're getting into, it's going to be very difficult up front to develop those habits. It's going to deplete you, use up some of your self-control reservoir, I would guess. But over time, eventually, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, I know what I have to do. You get the life jacket, the paddle, everything in here, and this is the best place to get into the river. And when you hit this eddy, this is what you do. It just seems natural then.
Exactly.
Got it. All right. So that brings me to your study that you conducted with Baumeister and Carrion. First of all, how did you get connected with these guys? I mean, you're a sociologist at UConn. Baumeister is, I think, a psychologist down at Florida State, and Carrion is a neuroscientist at Stanford. Now, that's three different fields, three different parts of the country. Did you guys all meet in Kansas or something? How'd you get connected?
Well, Roy, I just cold called when I came up with Soul Pulse, the idea for Soul Pulse. I said, hey, I'm applying for money. Do you want to be on this grant with me? Here's how I'm collecting data. And it's a pretty cool way of collecting data, and the study created data that aren't available, so he was interested. And then David Carrion actually contacted me. He'd been following a blog I used to have, and he was a friend of John Ortberg, who actually came up with the idea for Soul Pulse. It was his idea. It wasn't mine. But they needed someone who was an experienced researcher to conduct it. And so they reached out, and I've actually gotten to be pretty good friends with both of them. And I'm very interdisciplinary in my thinking, and I love learning from people in other disciplines.
Yeah, and it is one of the things that really makes your research really fun and interesting, and a lesson for graduate students out there is, yeah, it's okay to cold call people sometimes and pay attention to other people's blogs and say, hey, I got an idea here, let me call up somebody and do that kind of stuff. We mentioned Soul Pulse a couple times, and we will put a link back to the podcast that we had on it a couple years ago. But remind us exactly what Soul Pulse, I should not say is anymore, but what Soul Pulse was.
Mm-hmm. So Soul Pulse was what psychologists call an experiential sampling method study. In other words, it was a survey, but it didn't ask about life in general or average feelings or what happened last year. It was all about the moment. And so people who signed up got two surveys sent to them a day for 14 days. And each survey was 20 to 30 questions. Things like, what are you doing now? Are you happy now? Are you aware of God now? Different questions about, are you with anybody? Have you had anything to eat in the last 2 hours? So it's a micro longitudinal study of basically 28 waves over 14 days. So it's a way of detecting, its focus is state change, much more than trait change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people aren't going to change who they are fundamentally that much over 2 weeks, but there's a lot bouncing around hour to hour, day to day.
And one of the things that I found fun to do with the study, and I actually was one of the early participants when it came out. You do it on your cell phone. 20 questions seems like it's a lot, but it went pretty quick. It only took, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes to do. So not a lot of whole self-control there. But the cool thing was it had these little sliding scales, which I loved, right? You know, usually they give you a Likert scale that has 7 points on it. But this one says, you know, how are you feeling today? 0 to 100. And you can, you know, move your cursor back and forth to get to a certain point, which was neat. And the other thing that was very cool about it was that the questions didn't always repeat. There were different questions, different times.
Mm-hmm.
So what were some of the things? You already mentioned a few. You know, what did you eat in the past 2 days? Mm-hmm. What were some of the other things that you were probing for?
Oh, we had questions on anxiety, depression, flourishing. Do you feel sick? Have you had headaches? Who have you been with? Have you had conflict with a loved one recently? Have you had bad things happen? Did you go to church over the weekend? Do you feel grateful? Have you meditated recently? We really designed it to be sort of an omnibus survey about spirituality and well-being, something that could be analyzed to address a number of different research questions.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the spirituality angle in it, the soul in the soul pulse. What religious questions, right? Was it centered really around religion, or was it more just generally broad, how you feeling kind of stuff?
I would say that it was focused mostly on well-being, but there is substantial representation of both religious and spirituality measures.
Okay. Okay. And how many people participated in this over the past 3 years?
Oh, gosh, we probably had 5,000 people sign up.
Yeah.
And each person, the response rate was really high. So once they signed up, they finished about 70% of the surveys. Each survey had 20. So 5,000 times 20 is 100,000 times, and the numbers get to be big.
Yeah.
I think we have several million pieces of data or points of data in the data set now.
Wow.
And as much as anything, that's why we stopped collecting. It's like I need to stop thinking about getting data in and start thinking about how to get data out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Let me address one question that would come up, usually with these kind of studies. The issue of self-selection into the survey, does that cause any problems for you? How do you address that? Because the people who are going to sign up for Soul Pulse are already the ones thinking about soul. You're not going to get the soulless, you know, there might be a soulless pulse group out there. I don't know. But how do you deal with the self-selection? Is it really a problem for some studies or not for others?
Well, it's a convenience sample. It's a very diverse convenience sample, but it's still a convenience sample. So you're absolutely right. I mean, you put your finger on one of the biggest limitations, or at least things we have to address when analyzing Soul Pulse data. So it's important to remember for me, when I work with Soul Pulse data, that if I find X causes Y, I'm finding that X, or X is associated with Y, I'm finding this association among a certain type of person in society, tend to be older, tend to be wealthier, and tend to be interested in spirituality. Having said that, we did get some people who, at least in terms of religion, had no interest in religion. And so we can test for interaction effects if the association between X and Y is the same for people who go to church and people who don't, or are religiously affiliated or are not. So we have a lot of variation, but you're absolutely right. By definition, people who did it had smartphones, and they were interested in this kind of study.
Yeah, even though that is a limitation, it's still a wealth of information, because the fact that you're doing this over a two-week time span, you know, you do find people are tired at some points of the day. They do have conflict, and you can see those relationships within the data. And so it does have its generalizability there. So I thought just absolutely fascinating study or data collection method. Let's talk about how you applied this now to the study on self-control, or sinning, if we want to get a little spiritual here. First of all, how did you measure self-control?
Well, that was actually tough. That took us a long time to come up with something that we thought made sense. We ended up with three separate measures that we thought were associated with self-control. The first was a pretty standard, was actually the standard self-control scale for trait self-control. And it was things like, I'm the kind of person who does things without really thinking about them. I'm the kind of person who can resist temptation. I'm the kind of person who can, you know, do self-control things. That's out in the literature. It's been cited, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of times. But for self-control state, we had to create our own measure. And the funny thing about self-control, Tony, is that we're not always aware of when we have it. So I'm aware if I have a stomachache. I'm aware if my legs are feeling antsy. There's some things I'm aware of about myself. But self-control isn't something that you can ask them and say, how much self-control do you have right now? So we keyed in on some symptoms, and this is from Roy's work, of when people have more or less self-control. So our questions were, there are three questions. They were prefaced with a stem, in the past couple hours, have you felt that? And then the first question uses the statement, it's hard to make up your mind about even simple things. The second question is, things are bothering you more than they usually would. And the third question is, you have less mental and emotional energy than you normally have. So from Roy's work, those are three sort of symptoms of being low on self-control. So psychologists would call being low on self-control being in a state of ego depletion. And so this is a measure of ego depletion that gets at levels, that reflects underlying levels of self-control.
Okay. And define that a little bit more specifically. Ego depletion sounds like I just don't believe in myself anymore. What does ego depletion mean? Yeah.
So you can almost think of it as self-control depletion. That'd probably be a more intuitive name of it. So our sort of energy for ourselves and our ability to act on the world and delay gratification and things like that, how much of that do we have? And if we're low on it, then we're ego depleted.
Got it. Now, were these questions already in the Soul Pulse survey, or did you put them in after you contacted Roy and David and stuff?
Well, Roy was in on the study from the start.
Right.
So was
okay.
David.
Okay.
And so they both helped me design the study. And, David's such a smart guy. He started doing binomial probabilities in his head at one point. I'm like, come on, you're just showing off.
Yeah. He's got a lot of self-control on math.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so the Soul Pulse itself was designed to look at the interplay between self-control and also religion and spirituality. So we had to measure it, and these were the measures we came up with. So they were baked in from the start.
Okay. So baked in from the start. You got thousands of people participating in this, millions of data points through days and weeks of participating in this. What are we looking for in terms of how states affect our self-control? What are your independent variables that you're throwing in there?
Well, that's the big question. Because in the laboratory, most survey research has been on trait self-control. So you talk about the kinds of people who have more or less self-control, like more educated people have more self-control, things like that. But with state self-control, most of the research has been laboratory research. And there's some things you can do in laboratories that are more easy to do than others. So what we're looking at is what are the things in everyday life that deplete state self-control? And so, because there wasn't much of a literature to draw on based on everyday life in naturalistic settings, we had to do a bit of an exploratory analysis. And so we took a lot of things that theories and laboratory experiments suggested should matter, and we tested how they were associated with ego depletion. And what we found is, we looked at things like multitasking, not getting sleep, eating sweets, going to church, interpersonal conflict, time of day, day of week, activities, what you're doing, who you're with, all sorts of things. And some had no association, some had a little, and two of them had an enormously strong association with ego depletion.
All right, don't leave me hanging here. What are those? Well, actually, before you tell us what the two major things are, what were some of the minor things that affected ego depletion and self-control?
Well, it varies systematically throughout the day. So we start off the 6-7 in the morning on average. The Soul Pulse participants had low self-control. Then it started increasing rapidly until about mid to late morning, 10 or 11 o'clock. And that was their highest point of, there's the double negative here I want to avoid. So people are most depleted in the early morning, least depleted at around 10 or 11. And then they started getting more depleted again in the afternoon, so that they were most depleted around 4 or 5. Then they started getting recharged again after work. And so we found that pattern across people. Also varied by week. People were most depleted Tuesdays and Wednesdays, least depleted Saturdays, and especially Sundays. Now, the effect size were significant. We have a large sample to deal with. But they weren't that big. It was like a small to moderate effect, but I thought it was pretty interesting.
And I do too, because most people tell me and have advised me that, you know, successful writers. So off mic, we were talking about Rodney Stark, who we both admire a great deal. He's one of these guys who gets up every morning and just writes for 4 hours. So he's up at 6 and he's basically writing until 10. It kind of fits in your study. That's when you have a lot more self-control. Boom. By the time noon rolls around, hey, you know, just kind of slack off a little bit. And I get the sense of that, too. It's that I, you know, by about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, I'm starting to slog. The whistle bell goes off of work. Actually, doesn't quite for us academics, but, you know, I force myself to turn off for a little bit. And, boom, I get a little bit of recharge and heading out to the tavern or something, right? And having a little bit of fun with some folks. So that kind of makes a lot of sense. So, and days, Tuesday, Wednesdays, yeah, those usually suck. Sunday's kind of interesting. That's a day a lot of people go to church. I'm wondering if that has any effect. So tell us about the two biggies, the one things that matter the most.
Well, sleep and conflict. So not getting sleep depletes us substantially. Or not, actually, it's not, the amount of sleep has a small to moderate effect. It's the quality of sleep. So every morning, so Pulse participants, when they took their survey, would be asked, how well did you sleep last night? Or how long did you sleep? And then, how well did you sleep? And it was the how well question that really made a difference. And then, another question asked, in the past 12 hours, 24 hours, have you had interpersonal conflict? With friends, with loved ones, at work, things like that. Both of those had enormous effects. You would, a change in that would move depletion, ego depletion, one or two standard deviations. It was phenomenal what an effect they had.
Wow. It makes a lot of sense. We just recently brought a new puppy into our house, and puppies have a tendency to get up at 2 in the morning and 4 in the morning, and so whereas I can get maybe 7 hours of sleep in a night. I have one of these Fitbit things that measures your sleep, and I look at it the next morning, and it's like, ugh, looks really choppy. And the quality of sleep, I would have to say, has been pretty low. And I've been kind of noticing that, you know, self-control. I've been eating a few more desserts when I shouldn't and saying no to the gym and things like that. You probably didn't have a variable for puppies, but that it does work its way through.
We had kittens, we had goldfish, we had hamsters, we forgot puppies.
Yeah, you forgot puppies. Yeah, there you go. And then interpersonal conflict. I would imagine the more interpersonal conflict you have, the less likely you are to exercise self-control.
Yeah, if you want to see me with a little self-control, wait until after I've gotten into it with my wife or my kids or a friend or at work. That demonstrates how powerful this is. We created a variable, dummy variable, called extreme depletion, extreme ego depletion. And basically, we took the regular depletion variable and we just recoded it into a binary variable, where it was zero if they were in the lower 90% of observed ego depletion scores, and they were 1 if they're in the top 10%. And we found that when people slept well, of all the times that people slept well and had no conflict, not a single instance was the person in extreme depletion. In contrast, when they had poor sleep quality and high conflict, 44% of the time they were extreme depletion. Seriously, I reran it a couple times because I didn't believe it. The change was so big. I traffic in smaller effect sizes routinely, and this astonished me.
Wow. There's a lesson there. Get a lot of good sleep, kids, and be happy with everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think be nice to people.
Be nice to people. Have them be nice to you, too.
Has multiple payoffs. One is you have more self-control.
That's kind of interesting. Yeah, so successful people who do exercise that self-control, probably happier people. And the causation might run the other way. Happy leads to self-control.
Well, absolutely. And I was pretty careful to say the association between self-control these two things. Because you can think of people when they're in high self-control state, they can get themselves to bed earlier, they're not drinking as much at night, they're not eating food that'll keep them up. So maybe high self-control people sleep better. And then when you have high self-control, you don't say the stupid thing that's going to set off a bomb that you have to deal with interpersonal conflict. Or you're more caring, you're more attentive, whatever reduces conflict.
So before I ask of how you applied some of this stuff in your own life, I have to ask, because we're a show on religion, did any religious variables come up in the study showing that there's some effect of, you know, going to church or praying or being a religious person generally?
So we found some differences across religious affiliation, and it wasn't strong, but in general, and do you know what? I'm going to look this up because I'm going to get it wrong if I don't otherwise. I have a gift for finding cool stuff and then immediately forgetting what I found.
Well, you need a little bit more self-control there. You should have had that written down ahead of time. I don't know.
So people who have high religious beliefs, and there's actually a small literature on this, but a very interesting literature, tend to have more self-control, and they have less ego depletion. Other states have found it. We have found it. In addition, Catholics, Protestant people who are of other religions have higher levels of self-control than people who are religious nuns. And we found that. Other people found that. Now, there's the causal story is up in the air. It could be self-control. People with high self-control are attracted to religion. Right? If you want to spend your Sunday mornings bouncing around and sleeping, don't go to church. That's not a good place for you. But if you know, it takes self-control to do religion. But also, religion fosters self-control through a number of mechanisms. It teaches us that it's valuable. It gives us puts us around people who have higher self-control. It gives us a sense that God's monitoring us. So, you know, we should probably, you know, keep an eye on what we're doing. So there's different mechanisms by which religion can both result from but also cause self-control.
Any effect on prayer? Because that one seems to me to be a big one. I know people who pray regularly tend to be much more in control of their lives. Their interpersonal relationships are much better, because if anything starts heating up, you know, they just kind of say, okay, let's meditate on this for a little bit, and mm-hmm. you know, they come back down. So I would assume that there's an effect, at least some mild effect, with prayer.
I would assume so too. I haven't looked at it. I thought of saying, pause the tape, give me 5 minutes, and I'll give you the answer. But, that's just the cool aspect about Soul Pulse, is that I can literally do that. But that's something I'll probably look up tomorrow for my own curiosity.
Okay. And if you write a paper on that, I'm just asking for a little mentioned in the front. It was sponsored by Research on Religion, this idea for this paper or something like that.
This analysis is sponsored by.
Exactly. So that'd be a cool one to find out what is going on there. To end up here, one of the cool things that you did in the Christianity Today article was to talk about how this research really has affected you in your own personal life. And I always like to ask that question at the end, you know, has your research changed your mind on anything and you look at the world differently? This one has actually had a pretty significant impact on how you actually organize your life. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, absolutely. And in general, Tony, I'm moving from, oh, this is an interesting idea, let's just play with it, to, oh, what can make a difference in my life and others in my research? I just find it more engaging. So that's why self-control, which is both a cool puzzle intellectually, but also has clear practical applications, really appeals to me. The big thing is it's completely changed how I try to change my life. So before, if I'd want to change an aspect of my life, I'd take sort of a type A, big change, big decision, big commitment approach. Like, okay, this will be the summer I get in great shape, or this will be the week I solve this problem. And I tell you, my batting average is pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
And this has given me an understanding of why, is that I was trying to make a lot of change, and basically I was trying to run on effortful self-control rather than taking the time to automate behaviors. So I'll give you a real practical example, and I think I gave this in the article on Christianity Today. I wanted to start doing exercises in the morning to sort of wake myself up to start writing. And also I wanted to do some stretching exercises because I'm having problems with my left shoulder, and I'm supposed to do PT, but I always forget. So I thought, okay, I'll do it. In the past, what I would have done is, you know, here's my outline of what I'm going to do. Here's my schedule. And the first day I'd wake up and I'd hit it hard for 15 minutes. I'd be like, yeah, I got this. Second day, yeah, got this. Third day, oh, yeah, that's right, I got to do it. Fourth day, something would happen, but that's okay because I'll get it the fifth day. Fifth day, I'll get back to it. It's like, what was I doing? And then by the sixth or seventh day, I'd forgotten it. I mean, that pattern over different time frames has been very consistent in my life. This time, I started with a single tiny behavior. I did one burpee. That's all, just one burpee. You know, where you stand up, you reach the sky, then you squat down, you basically go up into a push-up position, you do a push-up, and then you pop back up, and then you hop up. So it's a good exercise for the body. I did just one. That's it, just one single one for like 3 weeks. But I got used to doing it, and I could do it every morning. And then I started adding more. So now I do about 12 minutes every morning without even thinking about it. In fact, it feels weird not doing it because I've done it for like 6-8 months now. And another month I'll add some more, and eventually it'll be what I want. But it's much more effective for me than trying to add all that I want. Now, that's an example of just physical exercises. But I'm also trying to intentionally incorporate habits to improve my marriage, to be a better father, to be a better friend, to memorize scripture, to eat better, all sorts of things. So it's given me a very different understanding of how to change things. And not wearing myself out or not running out of willpower and self-control unexpectedly all the time has been refreshing because I'm more aware of its power but also its limitations.
Yeah, that fits very well with the battery analogy that you gave earlier. Instead of just charging it, running in fifth gear right away really hard, you just take it smooth, and the battery will still be fully charged throughout the day, weeks, and months, I guess, yeah.
Exactly.
Very cool. So let me finish off then with this last one. What you got, Soul Pulse? You're going to be analyzing that kind of stuff for quite a while, I bet, with all that data that you have. And I expect to hear back from you on what the prayer variable affected there. But what else do you have in the queue that you're working on now?
Well, I just got another grant from Templeton.
Look at that.
I love those people. They
I know.
They're the best. They're very open to new things. And it's the thing I like about Soul Pulse the most is that it looks is the topic, spirituality, well-being states. I think that's so cool. So that micro-longitudinal analysis, really interesting. The problem is, even though we're looking at within-person differences, is that it's still observational data, and there's only so far you can go with observational data about causality. So you always have to talk about associations, not causation. So I have so I'm interested in getting into field experiments about spirituality. I've done field experiments before. That was a different podcast with you. But they were more like discrimination audit studies. So now I want to combine the methodology that I had before Soul Pulse with the topics of Soul Pulse. And so my grant is to conduct and teach other people how to conduct field experiments involving spirituality and religion.
Yeah. That sounds very cool, and that is something that we're going to have you back on the show again pretty soon. You're just starting this. You just got the grant.
Just got the grant. I mean, I don't even think the money's here yet. I think the contract was signed last month or something.
Wow. Very cool. Very cool. We're going to have to keep an eye on that and get you back because I know you're one of the guests that we've had the most on the show, and it's because you're one of the most enjoyable, creative, and exciting guests that we do have. So we'll be looking forward to see what happens with these field experiments.
Well, thanks. I'm not sure which way the causation is going here. I think it's gotten to the point where I pick topics based on how likely I think they are to get me on your show.
I think that's what it is. And it's keeping you going because research on religion is definitely a self-control issue. You should be listening to it every week, and you can just start simple with episode one and work your all the way up to 343, which is what we're at here. Once again, my guest has been Professor Bradley Wright. Brad, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
My pleasure as always. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if
if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.